Good evening, I'm Jeff Bennett. Tonight on PBS News Weekend, on this Juneteenth, we explore the day's evolution into a national holiday and meaningful ways to celebrate its significance. Then, blown glass artist Dale Chihuly's latest exhibit takes inspiration from the Arizona desert's landscape. And a special Father's Day weekend spotlight, NPR's Scott Simon reflects on the joys and challenges of being a dad.
You work for their joy. You work to try and do what's right for them and for the world. And I think that's a great motivating factor.
All that and the day's headlines on tonight's PBS News Weekend. Good evening. It's good to be with you. And we start with the day's headlines and news of an ethnic killing in Ethiopia that has claimed the lives of more than 200 people, one of the deadliest mass killings in the East African nation. Most of the dead are of the Amhara people, the country's second largest ethnic group. Witnesses say a rebel group, the Oromo Liberation Army, perpetrated the attack in the Oromia region. The group denies responsibility. Fighting in Ethiopia, fueled by ethnic divisions, has been ongoing for years. And back here in the U.S., Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says she expects an economic slowdown is coming, but not necessarily a recession.
I expect the economy to slow. It's been growing at a very rapid rate as the labor market has recovered and we have reached full employment. I don't think a recession is inevitable.
On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve approved the largest interest rate hike in more than a quarter century to combat inflation. Yellen also said today the administration is considering temporarily cutting the federal gas tax, amounting to 18.4 cents a gallon, to provide some relief at the gas pump. After record flooding last week forced its first closure in 34 years, Yellowstone National Park will partly reopen on Wednesday. Floodwaters wiped out bridges, washed out miles of roads, and forced the park to close just as peak tourist season is starting. Only the park's southern loop will reopen. The north loop will remain closed until further notice. Officials are still evaluating the damage, but rebuilding could take years and cost upwards of $1 billion. The massive heat wave that set records in the West and Southwest has expanded to parts of the Gulf Coast, Great Lakes, and the Carolinas. Punishing humidity levels means it feels even hotter. Tens of millions of Americans across the lower 48 are under heat warnings and advisories. In all, more than 240 million people will see temperatures over 90 degrees over the coming days. And flight delays and cancellations continued for a fourth day, leaving passengers stranded across the country. This weekend has seen the highest travel volume this year, numbers not seen since last Thanksgiving. And it could not come at a worse time, as airlines struggle to cope with staffing shortages and severe weather. Thousands of flights were canceled on Thursday and Friday, in addition to a whopping 6,400 delays yesterday. Cancellations today have already topped 800. And swimming's international governing body has adopted new rules for transgender athletes. The sports federation, known as FINA, voted to only allow swimmers who transitioned before the age of 12 to compete in women's events. FINA also proposed creating a new competition category for swimmers whose gender identity is different than their sex at birth. Some LGBTQ advocates are calling that decision discriminatory. And still to come on PBS News Weekend, the Arizona desert supplies the inspiration for blown glass artist Dale Chihuly's latest exhibit. And NPR's Scott Simon reflects on fatherhood, lessons learned, and those precious moments.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
Tomorrow marks the second time that Juneteenth, which honors the emancipation of enslaved African Americans, is being observed as a federal holiday. But some people are still figuring out how best to mark that holiday. My colleague John Yang spoke with two organizers about Juneteenth's meaning.
Jeff, Juneteenth dates back more than a century. It's gained traction in recent years with the police killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and has come to mean different things to different people. two perspectives now from Athenia Rodney, founder of Juneteenth NYC, and Melissa Rolfs, an organizer of Juneteenth events in San Bruno, California. Melissa and Athenia, thank you very much for joining us. Athenia, I'd like to start with you, and if you could just tell us a little bit about sort of your personal experience or history with Juneteenth. When did you first become aware of it and learn about its meaning?
Sure. Well, I first became aware from my best friend when I was in high school. She talked about Juneteenth and Black Solidarity Day. And then I went to college, and it became something that became more prominent to me because a lot of people would ask questions and I didn't know the answers. So it forced me to do research. It forced me to really learn and understand my history. And when I came back to New York from being away from college, I wanted to make sure that others knew the same because I didn't feel like it was something that was being taught in the school system. And it felt like the only way that we would be able to learn it is if we taught each other.
Melissa, how about you? How did you first become aware of Juneteenth and learn about its meaning?
Yeah, I didn't grow up learning about it in school and certainly not celebrating it as a child, but I have always been involved in my community in terms of culture and art. So it's been very recent as I've learned about the history of Juneteenth, and I was excited to incorporate it into my own community and talk to others about incorporating it, you know, just locally as a celebration.
And Athenia, how do you think this is best marked, best commemorated? Is it a day of celebration? Is it a day of reflection? Is it a call to action for the future?
I think this day should be marked with all of those. It is a day of celebration for all of the history that we have been able to achieve and the new marks that we've been able to make, the strides we've been able to make. It is also a day of reflection to think about those who lost their lives, to think about the blood that was shed, to think about slavery in itself and how it impacts and still continues to impact us now. And also, it's about unity. It's about how we are coming together as a community and how we continue to grow what we're doing so that we become more successful.
And Melissa, tell me about when you organized events in San Bruno, what you thought about and how you thought about how these events should be held.
Well, for me, I was invited to help plan the celebration with city employees who really lead cultural and arts programming for the community. And in our earliest conversations, one of the things that was important to me was I said, I think it's important to celebrate Black joy, Black community, and Black culture the way we celebrate those things for lots of other communities. And I think that message resonated with a neighbor who was also helping to plan the event and with the staff, with the city employees. So we really talked about it being a celebratory event and a little like a picnic that you might see on the 4th of July.
And Athenia, we've seen merchants getting into the act. JCPenney, I know, is advertising Juneteenth Day sales. We even had Walmart marketing Juneteenth ice cream. What do you make of that?
Part of my main mission really has been, since it's become a national holiday, is that it doesn't become commercialized, but it's more, or if it does become commercialized, but it's through using those who are creating things in their own community. So, for example, if Walmart would have contacted a business that was creating ice cream themselves. That was their brand. That was their business and what they were doing. And they said to them, hey, how can we help to improve what you're doing? How can we put what you're doing on our shelves? I think that would have been a better way to kind of do this.
And Melissa, but I would imagine your focus also is that you want people to remember the real meaning of how this day started. What was the original commemoration of this day? Do you worry that that might get lost over the years?
No, I think, you know, the Independence Day holiday, we all have barbecues and cookouts and things, but we remember why, you know, those fireworks that we enjoy, they're just beautiful now, are a reminder of the battles that were fought. I think it is important to explain the history lesson, and certainly in San Bruno's celebration, there was a discussion and speakers that talked about the history, but it was overall just a happy celebration.
And Athenia, how about you? Do you worry that as the years go by, that the sort of the central meaning of this day may get lost?
I do. I am concerned about that because I feel like with Martin Luther King Day, with Black History Month, I feel like it has gotten lost in translation, so to speak. And that's why we have focused our organization on three pillars. And one of our main pillars is education. And then the second is empowerment. And the third is edutainment, where we're educating through entertainment.
Athenia Rodney and Melissa Rolfs, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In the desert of Arizona, you can visit one of famed architect Frank Lloyd Wright's homes. But for the past few months, the site has also been home to an installation by glass artist Dale Chihuly. Special correspondent Mike Saray looks at how the work of these two artists came together amid the rugged landscape.
For generations, Arizona's deserts have attracted and inspired American artists and creatives. It was here that architect Frank Lloyd Wright built his iconic winter home, Taliesin West, in the foothills of the McDowell Mountains, outside of Scottsdale, Arizona. It's now the home of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, where Nikki Stewart is head of engagement.
Taliesin West has a long history of artists and architects living and working here, but not a very long history of doing art exhibitions.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Glass artist Dale Chihuly, an admirer of Wright's incorporation of design with nature, is the first artist allowed to display his work at Taliesin West.
Oh yeah, it's a dream come true. I mean, Taliesin West is such an incredible complex, and it's really a great honor to be able to make six installations.
The exhibit named Chihuly in the Desert includes his alabaster and amber interpretation of desert flora and red reeds and bulbous glass floats in the surrounding pond. It took 4 years of working and reworking the designs between the Taliesin team in Arizona and the Chihuly studio team in Seattle, where the thousands of hand-blown glass pieces for the installations were made. Dale Chihuly's wife, Leslie, is the head of Chihuly's studio and workshop.
The idea was to really work in concert with nature, to first notice the nature, appreciate the surroundings, and site works and site architecture in a way that was complementary to and not dissonant to the beautiful natural surroundings.
She says her husband's fascination with Frank Lloyd Wright started in college, where Dale Chihuly originally studied architecture before becoming a glass artist.
It's nice the way you look through it.
Yeah. I think it's very much a dance of heat and light, and it's a dance of vision, and it's a dance of experimentation, playfulness, building on ideas. And you can see, even if you look at the works around this property, the two of them both have a real curious mind and a hungry mind when it comes to beauty, beautiful objects, and then placing things within the interior and exterior settings.
They're both inspired by the natural world, by nature, and they feel like the organic architecture of the world, of nature, of the trees and the ground and the mountains should determine how either the building or the sculpture sits in its space.
30 minutes south of Wright's home is Phoenix's Desert Botanical Garden, where Chihuly's desert interpretations were first displayed in 2008.
I think that you could refer to it as the agave on steroids.
Elaine McGinn is director of experience at the Botanical Garden, which collaborated with Taliesin West on this Chihuly in the Desert exhibition, currently on display at both locations.
You see the agave is a much shorter form, but the spiky points of it, the way it catches the light, and also the elongation that he creates, really drawing your eye to it.
Visitors from around the country have their own reactions to this mix of art and desert.
I was really surprised at how beautiful the juxtaposition of the art and the nature was.
You have a boat in the middle of the desert filled with all these colors. At first glance, you would say, well, this isn't indigenous to the desert at all.
Every color that you see in this boat, you can find here in the garden. The orange of some of the cactus flowers that are blooming, and then we've got greens and yellows and reds. During the day, the light is reflected off of the sunlight, and it changes and transforms throughout the day until we get to the sunset. The sunlight becomes more subdued. The lights that are on each of the installations start to come on and illuminate the pieces, and the colors shift. The forms become more evident as you're looking at the pieces, so it's a very different experience.
It was really very good combination of, you know, natural plants and, you know, some combination with some artificial things, but all good, very well. Very well designed.
As popular as the exhibit has been, there were concerns about how Chihuly's art would work with Wright's austere architecture and the environment.
There may have been some concern about what the final effect would be, because for so long, people have come here to see Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture in a desert landscape without interference.
You can have any kind of experience you want. You can enjoy Taliesin without the Chihuly, and you can have an experience of Taliesin with the Chihuly. And you get to decide.
Leslie, do you think this kind of punctuates the beauty of the plants, or does it detract from it?
I think it just stays with it. It's like a nice, contrast with it.
They do see the artwork, and then their eye just naturally goes to the plants, and then it becomes about the garden and sort of their own discovery.
For PBS News Weekend, I'm Mike Saray.
Now to our weekend spotlight. And on this Father's Day, I can think of no one better to talk to than Scott Simon, author and host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Earlier in my career, I worked with Scott as a Weekend Edition producer and editor. And few people have spoken as honestly and openly about the joys and challenges of fatherhood as Scott has. We sat down together at NPR recently, and he shared his perspectives on being a dad. How has being a father changed you?
What I discovered is from the first moment when you hold your child, and it only expands, your heart leaps out of you. Your heart leaps into them. They carry around a part of your heart. If they're cold, you're cold too. If they're frightened, you're frightened too. If they're hungry, magically you feel hungry too. You're never alone again in a way that you may have once felt in the world. Even before I think we held each of our daughters, when we saw their pictures, when they came from the adoption agency in China, I think we began to feel that way. And then to hold them, I can't explain it, but there's almost like a magical transference. It goes through your heart, it goes through your arms, you hold them, and you feel they've just absorbed a part of your heart.
You know, I've always thought that as your kids get older, they need you less. I have a son who's 9 now, and I've realized that that's not the case at all.
Absolutely.
As they get older, they need you more.
Absolutely true. We discovered that also. Oh, we thought, you know, I mean, there are ways in which, I mean, you know, they can make sandwiches by themselves. They certainly can, you know, can handle the remote control. But in all the important ways, they need you more than ever. They're encountering more in life. They have more questions. They have more, I think they have more anxieties, you know, as their world grows larger. One of the things that we have to adjust to in terms of being a parent is to understand as they grow up the days when they just kind of toddle across the floor and hold up their hands and ask for your help, for the most part, that's gone. They have different ways of asking for help. And we have to learn to recognize the signals in the language and be of what help we can without lecturing.
What are your greatest joys as a dad?
My greatest joy as a father is to see our children growing up and growing independent and becoming brilliant, as far as I'm concerned, but also every now and then needing me for something and remembering where I can fit into the world. And one of the great joys you realize is that you need them. It's not a one-way relationship. You work for their smiles. You work for their joy. You work to try and do what's right for them and for the world. And I actually think I think that's a great motivating factor.
I feel like kids, when they have ambitious parents, will pick up that ambition. Kids who have resilient parents will pick up that resilience. But I found it harder to instill empathy in kids. How have you done that?
I think the most important thing, and it came hard, I've learned about being a father and learned about being a parent, is you can't really teach anything. The only thing that counts is your example.
Wow.
Your children will see what kind of person you are. Your children will see what kind of values you have. Your children will see how you treat other people. Your children will see how you treat each other in an intimate marital relationship. Your children will see how people react to you. The whole idea, do as I say, not as I do, that doesn't work for children. They know the difference. They're not going to let us off that easy. And I think that's fine. I think children help us to be maybe better than we set out to be, because we want to be that in their eyes.
Your girls are 15 and 19. As you think back, what are some of the moments that just bring a smile to your face?
Elise, our oldest daughter, was 4 when we adopted our youngest daughter, who was, I think, 7 months old. And we got this this little picture from the adoption agency of this little girl, this baby. And we went to China for our second time. And they said, you know, stay in your room. They knocked on the door,
really?
And they bring in this little girl, this baby. And maybe because she was like 3 or 4 months older than when we got the picture, they put her down on a table. And my wife said, are you sure she's the right one? And our oldest daughter reached out her hand. And she took the hand of this little baby, her new sister, and said, it doesn't matter. And of course, wow. She was right.
Yeah.
And my wife and I looked at each other like, where did she learn that goodness? Where did that come into her heart? We stayed in a hotel room once. It was in the early days when the in-house coffee makers were just coming in. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this was great. I mean, we were, oh, this is great. I don't have to, oh, this is great, this is great. So after 2 days, wherever we were, we get into the cab, and our oldest daughter was then hauling around a little pink backpack with Hello Kitty on it. And we pick up the backpack when we get into the cab to go to the airport, and it's much heavier than usual. I thought, what's in there? You can see where this is going. And we unzipped the backpack, and she had put the coffee maker in there. And I will never forget her smile, like, yeah. Well, you like the coffee maker, yeah. See what I did. It was just hilarious. I think what happens when you have the vision of a parent or a father is that you see your children as being all ages at once. Mm-hmm. I mean, I look at our 19-year-old and our 15-year-old, and I know they're just about grown, and I hope I recognize them as adults. But also, at some point when I look at them, they are always the 2 and 3 and 4-year-old that I remember. You don't forget that. You see them as being at all ages at once. And that's something that's very precious. You know, there are times, I think, particularly over these past 2 years when I've been anxious, I haven't been able to get to sleep, I've been worried about this or that. I confess, I think about our daughters, and I think about some of those wonderful winsome times when they were just discovering the world and I might have been around to help, and the memory of them and their presence in my life that I feel even now has put me in touch with a kind of joy and a kind of relief that gets me through the next hour. Every now and then, our daughters kid me a lot, and I think that's great. But every now and then I hear from another parent, you know, your daughters really think you're okay. And I just think, well, I think that's the biggest compliment I've ever had.
And online, after his passing yesterday, we remember our friend Mark Shields and his more than 30 years contributing to our broadcast. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is PBS News Weekend for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us here at PBS News Weekend, thanks for spending part of your Sunday with us, and happy Father's Day.